Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of May. It's All Things Political this hour with the editor-in-chief of the progressive magazine, Ruth Conniff. Is the Republican Party coming apart? Are we seeing a kind of nationalism that, as Patrick Healey writes in yesterday's New York Times, has not flared up so intensely since the original America First movement before Pearl Harbor? Donald Trump is ready to meet with U.S. intelligence officials for classified briefs, but his top advisor has a long career working for pro-Russian forces in Ukraine. A former Republican national security official says he's an intelligence classification vetting nightmare scenario. Hillary Clinton will soon be interviewed by the FBI about her private email server. Are there concerns about her ability to protect sensitive information? In a recent piece about Bernie Sanders, Ruth writes, "What Sanders is doing is important. Without him, the progressive issue he raises would not become the critical national issues of the 2016 campaign." What a campaign season we got going. Ruth Conniff is our guest this hour, and she's always a terrific guest. She's editor of the Progressive magazine, native of Madison, Wisconsin, first joining the magazine when she was hired as a summer intern after her sophomore year at Yale. And we are going to be welcoming phone calls. I think that, you know, with all that's going on, we're going to have a lot of calls because there's so much to talk about. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. And Ruth, hello. Thanks very much for being with us this Monday.
Hello. Nice to be here.
What a thing we got going here, right? it's really unbelievable.
It's a very interesting political year.
You can say that again. So is the Republican Party falling apart?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fair to say the Republican Party is falling apart. It's, you know, it's really unprecedented to see the chair of the Republican National Convention refuse to endorse the nominee, and then the likely nominee, Donald Trump, and then for that likely nominee to say that maybe he will strip Paul Ryan of his ability to lead the convention. I mean, it's really something. We thought there might be a contested convention and there might be multiple ballots and a battle over who the nominee would be, but we didn't know that there would be actually a battle over who would control the convention itself. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and then Ryan evidently said today, if Trump wants me to step down, I'll do that. Not as speaker, but as, you know, the head of the convention, he'll leave.
A lot of people are not going to Cleveland. It's going to be easier than to find housing there, it turns out.
Are you going?
Yes, I will be there. I'll be at both political conventions, usually am.
What a time you're going to have. I found this story fascinating over the weekend. Trump has this evidently senior advisor, so if he's privy to classified briefings, which the candidates are, I guess, after the convention, his top advisor has all these ties to Russians and to Putin and to forces, pro-Russian forces in Ukraine. People are saying we don't really want to give them classified information. It's a little scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Paul Manafort, who was a Lee Atwater acolyte, is a masterful political operator, but he has also been an advisor to a lot of unsavory characters and actually got John McCain in trouble for this reason by helping some unsavory folks get close to McCain during his presidential bid, earning the lasting enmity and worry of McCain's advisors at the time. So yeah, he's a really questionable person to have so close to the Trump campaign. He's really very powerful within the campaign. He's not his national security or foreign policy advisor per se, but it raises this question because as you begin to look at what Trump's foreign policy might turn out to be, should he develop one, you know, the people that he's talking to have some pretty shady ties.
Mm-hmm. And then we have Hillary Clinton, who has yet to be interviewed by the FBI about her private email server, but probably will be meeting with them soon. Are there concerns about that? And are there concerns, some have said, about her ability to protect sensitive information?
Well, I'm sure any time you have a Republican guest on, they mention the possibility that Hillary could be indicted.
Right.
I mean, this is something that we're going to hear over and over again. And, you know, I think it's unlikely that the Obama Justice Department is going to indict Hillary Clinton in the lead up to the Democratic convention. But, you know, it's not completely impossible. And, the question, there's a debate. There's been an ongoing debate about how bad it was for her to maintain this separate server in her home. She, you know, points out that Colin Powell did something very similar. Bernie Sanders dismissed it early in the campaign. But there's a, I think, if not the sense of illegal or corrupt acts so much, there's a sense of secrecy and hiding information as a reflex in the Clinton campaign that makes a lot of American voters uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And then we have Bernie Sanders, who remains in the race, and you wrote a really very nice article about him, very insightful article about him recently, in which you talked about the importance of his campaign in raising issues that perhaps would not be front and center without him.
Yeah, I mean, this is a year of massive rebellion by ordinary people who feel that our political class no longer represents us. And that it was really captured by the Bernie Sanders campaign. And I think if it hadn't been Bernie Sanders, it could have been Elizabeth Warren or it could have been somebody else. But I think what the Sanders campaign has really shown is that there are an awful lot of people, and not just people who are, you know, Democratic voters. There are people on the left and the right. There are independents. There are a lot of young people who've never voted before who feel like there's something profoundly wrong with the way we conduct politics in this country, that people with a lot of money control our political system, and that as a result of that, there are a lot of things that are off the table that shouldn't be off the table in the richest country in the world. We should be able to provide health care to everybody. We should be able to send people to college for very low or no tuition. You know, there are things that we could do if we had the political will, but the powerful players in politics are the people with a lot of money in this country. Mm-hmm. That's why you saw this big demonstration in April in Washington, D.C. There were 1,300 arrests, a whole lot of people with this coalition, Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening, who are arguing that we're really shutting down democracy in the United States, and that's the problem. We need to have a very different vision of how we go forward as a democracy.
Mm-hmm. And he's likely to win West Virginia tomorrow, isn't he? He's got some wins ahead of him.
Yeah, and I mean, Indiana was a significant win that didn't get a lot of attention.
Yes, it was.
So I think there's no doubt that Sanders continues to have a message that's deeply moving to people who listen to him, that there's something very important there, and that it would be a mistake to dismiss that and say, okay, we had this primary, you know, that's over, and we're going to move on with politics as usual, because that message is that politics is broken, and people are really feeling that. You know, in the Republican Party, it's quite evident, and in the Democratic Party, too.
Yeah, but Ruth, does it really make a difference once the election is over, if Hillary Clinton does become the nominee, so you've got a Democratic platform and it addresses some of Bernie's issues, does it mean anything?
Well, I think it means something to the extent that politicians are ambitious people who you know, seek office, and they compile political and financial capital to do that. And part of what they have to do is look at where the wind is blowing in the country. And to the extent that there is a really strong gust from this populist progressive revival, it will influence politicians. It's not really about the individual leader. But I think that you've already seen Hillary Clinton moving in that direction. Now, it's going to change in the general election, and it's going to be a wild general election. So we'll see what happens. But I think anybody running for president of the United States in 2016 would be crazy not to look at income inequality, the effects of our trade policies, and the other issues that are so important to voters and are so much motivating people to come out and vote and make a lot of noise this year. So I think, yeah, I think it does make a difference.
So with the mood being what it is it just Donald Trump's celebrity status that has people more drawn to him than to Bernie Sanders? There's a similar, perhaps, kind of anger, but their policy solutions are enormously different.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this over the weekend as all of these Republicans were coming out to defend Republican principles against Donald Trump. And I was really, I mean, I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but not entirely, when I say, okay, what are those core values that the Republican Party is, you know, is defending against the likes of Donald Trump? I mean, and I think what it comes down to in Paul Ryan's case is Reaganomics. And the Republicans have held together a coalition that was not going to hold together forever, of low-income, working-class people who have really suffered the brunt of our trade policies, and who have bought into the idea that we should take away services and benefits that are funded by taxes from others. And there's a racial subtext to that message. That's always been part of the formula. And then at the same time, we should cut taxes on corporations and the very wealthy, and somehow the benefits will trickle down. Well, you know, we've been through enough decades now to see that that is not working particularly well for low-income working folks. And so, you know, it wasn't going to go on forever. Trump comes along and he says to people, you know what? You can have the racism. You can have the xenophobia. You can point at the illegals who you feel are taking your jobs. And at the same time, we can do something about trade policy. We don't have to have economic policy that says we're going to make medical care harder and harder to get and we're going to outsource your jobs. You can have the whole package. You know, the Pat Buchanan message, that is a combination, it's a right-wing populist message. It's a combination of nationalism and America firstism and white supremacy, really, pretty boldly. And at the same time, really addressing the hurt of working Americans. And the Republicans for too long have not addressed that hurt. And they have capitalized on this coalition based on resentment and enriching the very rich. And it is not working now.
And also use the racial subtext in order to win elections. So in a sense, they might be the very reason that Trump is popular. They helped create a Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think they helped. I think that, you know, talking about welfare queens, as Ronald Reagan did, you know, using these not too subtle, racially tinged terms to talk about people, the takers and the makers, as Paul Ryan likes to put it. You know, the idea that there is this class of people, mostly black and brown, who get a lot of your taxes to pay for their benefits and they're not as hardworking as white Americans is just a set piece of Republican campaigns. And, you know, Lee Atwater, actually, who I mentioned earlier, was a master of it. So that's part of the problem. They've created that. They've toyed with some really dark stuff. But the other part of the problem is that there's a set of policy positions. And, you know, Paul Ryan is looking like the great man of principle now. But
right.
I've seen his PowerPoint. You know, I've seen the, you know, the budget plan that he presented that the Catholic bishops denounced as being completely anathema to Christian values that, you know, because it's so hard on the poor. And it is trickle down. It is the idea that all we need to do is cut corporate taxes and somehow working class people will get rich. And that is just a hard sale to make in Janesville, Wisconsin today.
And the nationalism that Trump espouses, does it have a whole lot to do or not very much to do with terrorism in this country and abroad mostly?
Well, certainly. I mean, right, when we hear about the Muslims who allegedly cheered in New Jersey when the World Trade Center collapsed, I mean, he's stoking a unifying sense of us and them. A sense of fear. You know, this is an old-fashioned style of politics. You know, I mean, the way Obama put it when he was running for president was they're trying to scare up votes. You know, making people feel very insecure, looking for this strong leader who will save us. I mean, that's an old style of politics, and it resonates with people when they're afraid. You know, and people are afraid of terrorism.
So what about his strategy? He's saying that he's got appeal all over this country, that he indeed could win places like Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and he could do it on his own. He doesn't need Ryan. He doesn't need any of the former presidents who are not showing up for the convention. He can just do this. Can he?
I don't know. He's shooting from the hip. And I think that what Trump is really good at is knowing what appeals to his audience. And part of what appeals to his audience is this anti-establishment posture that he's taken. And he knows that leaning into that is good for him. He's not playing the game the way people usually play it. So when he takes on Paul Ryan, he really consolidates support among people who think that they've been betrayed by the leadership of the country, by this political class, you know, Republicans and Democrats alike. And he senses that. He's got a great sense of it. How it plays out in terms of getting votes across the country in an election where he's running against a Democrat, I think is an entirely different matter. And I don't think he knows. But, you know, one thing that is really, I think, a powerful statement that a caller on National Public Radio made was, you know, I believed it, all the pundits say, you know, Donald Trump is a joke, he's not going to last, then he's only going to get to 30%, he'll never win, then it's going to be a contested convention, he won't be the nominee. So I think it would be wise for people who watch politics to take a breath before, you know, starting to say, oh, this is a joke, all the benefit of Trump's candidacy is going to accrue to Hillary Clinton, she's going to win running away. way the down ballot Democrats are going to win. I mean, that's a very optimistic scenario that you hear. But I am not so sure. I think that there's a pretty powerful message that Trump has, and it's going to cut across different groups of voters. And can he win with that message? I mean, I guess it depends largely on whether, you know, who comes out to vote and whether people are so turned off by a really negative campaign
right.
that voter turnout is suppressed. And then, you know, they're competing over a small slice of voters, and it just depends who's more energized.
Can you imagine what this campaign is going to be? Can you imagine the ads, Ruth? Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
It's just going to be ugly.
Yeah,
ugly, ugly, ugly.
Yeah. We'll talk more about Paul Ryan, because I thought it was interesting when he said that he couldn't at this point support Trump, but they're meeting evidently on Thursday of this week. I wonder what that meeting will be like. So we'll listen to what Ryan said and what Trump said and what Ryan is doing here in terms of his public pronouncements, and he's had several of them, actually. And we'll welcome phone calls. We'll go to phone calls first. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. If you like us, then you'll get little messages about who we have coming up, and you most of you probably would like to have that information. We're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Lines are open for you right now. Our guest this hour, the editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine, Ruth Conniff. You are listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, All Things Political, the editor-in-chief of the Progressive, Ruth Conniff, is our guest. Our phone lines are humming, so let's go to some phone calls, and we start with Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire. Claire, are you there? Claire is not there. Pat in Madison. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Great. I wanted to talk about the politics in Cleveland and the convention. My mother was a political reporter in the 60s and 70s, and when she went to the convention in 68, and it was really contested about Vietnam and alternative candidates, it turned into a riot. Chicago police broke her leg. So I hope our reporter there will be very careful. But I think it could get very, very ugly in Cleveland. We've already seen protests and people slugged. And so, you know, I think this is a very, very dangerous environment. You know, there are people that are very hostile and the racism is very dangerous. So I'm wondering what our progressive reporter thinks about all of this.
That's a little nerve-wracking.
Yes, it is.
Really? Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, I was at a Trump rally in Iowa where he was calling on members of the crowd to punch a protester and really getting a rise out of people talking about that. So I think it's a dangerous time in the country, and I think Trump is pulling some really dangerous people close to him. And some of the people who are really excited to go to Cleveland are people who want to protest Trump. So there will be, you know, there will be a lot of security, and there'll be a lot to worry about.
Thank you very much, Pat, for your call. An email about Bernie Sanders. He just broke the back of Wall Street. He emphasized campaign finance reform. And this is the miracle story of the election system raising such money by single donations.
Yeah, I think it's really a bright spot in this election year that Bernie Sanders, and it became this call and response chant at his rallies when he said his average campaign
right.
contribution was, and everyone yelled, $27.
Right.
You know, that is really pushback to the influence of mm-hmm. concentrated wealth in elections.
Let's go next to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. You know, I find this all just fascinating. I do not believe Trump will be elected president. I don't think the numbers are there from what everyone says. But let's just suppose he were to be. And I'm just wondering what your guest thinks. If he were to be elected president, he's not going to have a Congress under either party that is supportive. All right? There's no one that's going to be supporting other than his cabinet appointees. I'm just wondering, what do you think he will do? He's not going to build a wall, or he may start it. He's not going to move 12 million people around. That's just not feasible. Is it just going to be 4 years of absolute nothing? Will it be potentially impeachment, or do you think he'll do another Trumpian about face and start advocating single-payer health care?
Well, that'd be interesting.
All right, I'll listen off the air.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Trump knows what he would do. I mean, you know, I think it was back in the 2008 race when there was a brief surge by a very little-known candidate who fell back shortly afterwards. Maureen Dowd made the analogy to the dog who chases the car and then catches it and doesn't know what to do with it. I don't think Trump has really planned out his presidency, and I think he's got a really uneven array of policies. So will he start rounding people up and putting them in camps? I mean, that's the darkest idea. I think that he would pursue a very different trade policy. I think that's one of his, you know, that's a major emphasis for him. And I think he would make a big deal about that when he took office. And so, you know, would he get fast-track trade authority? I mean, that would be sort of an interesting fight in Congress. But, you know, it's kind of hard to look down the road and imagine the Trump presidency. It is, for a number of reasons, kind of a boggling prospect.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you can think of a time in history, Ruth, when you had a candidate who seemed to be as fuzzy about what was going on in foreign countries and foreign affairs and in history and everything, actually, as Donald Trump.
Well, we have talked about this before. We talked about it with George W. Bush. We talked about it with Ronald Reagan. But they had teams of advisors who were in place pretty early on and a much more serious set of people around them. I mean, Bush was pretty open about the idea that he would just hire people to figure that stuff out for him, and he did. So, you know, we had the neocons running foreign policy for a while in this country. But to be proudly ignorant the way Trump is you know, it makes you cringe as an American, actually. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, thank you so much for your call. Tony in Heartland. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I think the development of Trump is kind of been coming. The reason why is because we have a lot of career politicians, and we have a lot of politicians like our governor and stuff like that, where the Fourth Estate has not held them their feet to the fire. It's basically giving them softball questions, giving them passes. They're no longer the watchdog over government. So now you have all sorts of people thinking that they can run the government and that they can be part of the elected class. And more there is a disconnect between those who pay the taxes and cast the votes and those that sit up in the ruling class and make decisions based on who they're having dinner with every night, which is not the people that are casting the ballots and paying the taxes.
Ruth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is exactly the feeling that an awful lot of people have, and that is the reason that we saw both the Bernie Sanders and the Donald Trump campaigns take off. And in addition to that, I mean, the caller touched on the media's role. I talked to Ralph Nader a couple of days ago about the whole political year, which was interesting. And, you know, he talked about how hard candidates who didn't have a lot of votes had to fight to get into the debates. Getting into the presidential debates was this really important goal. And now, this year, we've had these debates where the discourse is so appalling and there's so little substance. It's really the reality TVification of presidential debates on the Republican side. Mm. And that has been very lucrative for television executives. And so to some degree, I think you have to look at the role that the commercial media have played in pursuing the Donald Trump story because they got a big audience share and a lot of advertising out of it. And so that, you know, commercialization of our political process is, it's partly because people were making money on it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw, I'm sure you did, Frank Bruni's column yesterday about Donald Trump, but he found all of these quotes that Donald had about his sexual capabilities and how terrific he was when he was on the Howard Stern show. I mean, the stuff is just, you know, you read it and you think, I don't consider myself a prude, but are you serious? You can dig up all of these comments? I would never think of talking to somebody on the air, and that's what we would talk about. It's just,
yeah.
And he's a presidential candidate now. He's the nominee. It's incredible to me. It's just incredible.
Well, I don't think, Kathleen, anybody expects you to become a shock jock. It's unlikely you're going the Howard Stern route.
I think you're right.
But, yeah, I mean, it's gross. And I think, you know, when
gross.
Ted Cruz finally kind of lost it because of
right,
this and
right.
quoted some of it, right? He talked about his venereal disease was his personal Vietnam. And,
yeah.
you know, it's hard to take. And I think it's hard to take for people who are serious about their conservative religious values.
Yeah. Let's go to Karen in Madison next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. You referred earlier in the show to the last time this type of atmosphere was predominant, and that's during the 30s with the Father McCaughlin movement and everything. And I study history to give me hope and information about the future. And it was very gross then. It was very racial. The radio waves were full of hate, and yet we made it to Roosevelt. So this time is a time of great risk, but there's also hope in what happened before, although this is the only first time since that time when things have been so horrible between people. What do you think?
Well, Karen, let me ask you, why do you think it's happening now?
Oh, because I think the same desperation is afloat. That was the beginning of the Depression. People didn't feel responded to by Hoover. And then a powerful man, interestingly a Catholic priest, right. but with the same debased, character, used it to manipulate people's fears. And I think we're as afraid now, apparently, as we were then. But if we just... I don't know. It's just the example of things haven't worked out. It doesn't look very good right now. I mean, Trump is a maniac, but we got through the Father Coughlin movement. And there was a great deal of nationalism mm-hmm. because of the Second World War.
Right.
Nobody wanted to go into Europe. And it seems like the same flavors are abroad.
Mm. What do you think, Ruth?
I think that's right. I mean, I think... fear, anxiety, and people have a really deep sense of economic insecurity in this country. There's a sense that, kids are carrying this massive college debt when they graduate. It's not at all clear where the middle class jobs are. You don't have a sense of being able to exit college into a decent paying job that will help you raise a family, buy a house, and send your own kids to college. I mean, that is all up in the air now. And people are very, very worried. And I think fear and anger are really close to each other in the brain. And people retreat into this kind of they look for scapegoats, and it's a political strategy to activate that. It's the opposite of what Roosevelt did when he talked about we have nothing to fear but fear itself, when he tried to help people see a more constructive path and pull together and nurture a sense of community. You know, when you see what Scott Walker did in this state, he really spoke to people's resentment of others who had a little bit more than they did. So public employees don't deserve to have unions and benefits because non-union private sector workers don't have them. And that was effective. It divided people, and it caused us to go down this road in Wisconsin where we've made a lot of deep cuts in public services. We have not, in fact, grown jobs, which was supposed to be the byproduct of that. And people are even more angry and even more fearful. So I think Trump takes us in the same direction. And there's really two possibilities. You can get really angry and really scared and scapegoat people. You can talk about foreign workers taking American workers' jobs. And, you see violent backlash against low-income foreign workers with no protections because white working-class folks are feeling angry. Or you can look up where the policies are being made and think about, how do we pull together as a community and make better policy? And that's it takes a calmer, emotional climate to get people to think that way. And that's why Trump is so dangerous.
Yeah. We haven't spent much time talking about Hillary Clinton, and she's probably going to be the Democratic nominee. What kind of administration, what issues are near and dear to her? The second part of the question is, the Times had an interesting piece about the number of women who are supporting her and a lot of money coming from women. Will she carry the day for the November election? And do you see any of Bernie Sanders' progressive ideas, which have dominated the Democratic debates, winding their way into her administration should she win?
Well, she's begun to move in that direction. She moved from not wanting a $15 minimum wage to embracing the idea of a $15 minimum wage. She started at 12 after the Fight for 15 movement had really gained some traction. So she, in that way, she's moving in that direction. She changed her position on the TPP, so she's become more concerned during the campaign, or at least, you know, addressed voters' concerns about job outsourcing through these trade deals. She is definitely running as the candidate of women this year in a way that she really did not in 2008. And, you know, in the Donald Trump-Hillary Clinton matchup, that's a pretty obvious, you know, divide, because Donald Trump is such an overt misogynist and there's so much to work with there. So I think there's going to be a campaign around women's issues and really just, and kind of a cultural campaign of respect for women that's divorced somewhat from policy. I mean, she talks about equal pay. She is pro-choice, and that's an issue. That's an area where women have lost a lot of ground lately. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, it's a core reason she has such strong support from women's groups, because a lot of people see access to birth control and abortion disappearing on the horizon, and politicians not caring enough about it. So I think that will be a big part of her administration. Of course, she was Secretary of State. So I think she's going to run, and I think she would govern as somebody who has a deep and subtle knowledge of foreign policy and would make America safe. But she's also a bit of a hawk in the Obama administration. She's more of an interventionist, and that gives people on the progressive side some pause.
Right. Damien, thanks very much, Karen, for your call. Damien in Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Well, I agree with your last caller that Trump is indeed a maniac. And it's my personal belief that to protect ourselves from people like this, we should add an amendment to the Constitution that states if you have ever performed inside of a WWE wrestling ring or a Comedy Central roast has been held in your honor, you should probably be disqualified from running for president of the United States.
I don't know if we can push that through, but I bet Paul Ryan would be open to that for the convention in Cleveland. And I watched the president, you know, the press dinner where he was, you know, where Trump was notably absent, and the president mentioned, oh, but we had so much fun last time. So I actually went back and rewatched his remarks about Trump, which were pretty devastatingly brutal in the last press dinner, where he, when Trump was, you know, leading the birther movement, was seated in the center of the room, and Obama flashed up this slide of a Trump White House that was covered with bling, and he talked about how Trump had made these important decisions, and he gave this kind of long, painful blow-by-blow of celebrity chef, and, you know, how he, right. he did the strong thing and fired Gary Busey, and, I mean, it was just kind of awful, but it was to make that point, like, you know, the tawdriness of his background is really pretty stunning.
And leading the whole birther movement, wasting so much time about something that was so wrong. It just, ooh.
Well, you know, there's a big wave to ride there. I mean, we have Sarah Palin in Wisconsin now campaigning against Paul Ryan. And,
right.
you know, there's that. I think that issue, that birther issue, was a subtler race card. It was, you know, a way of saying Obama's not a real American because he's an African-American. And that, you know, that's out there. I mean, that's going to be a current in this election.
Mm. Well, we'll hear from Paul Ryan and Trump's response to Paul Ryan and try to figure out what Paul Ryan's doing and how relevant he is, not only to the party now, the Republican Party, but the future. And welcome more of your phone calls. All things political. We're busy here today. Lots of calls. Just keep trying. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ruth Conniff is our guest. Ruth is editor-in-chief of The Progressive. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Let's go to Kyle in Iowa. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi, Kyle.
Really like NPR. The problem I have is I never hear you guys do a balanced approach on the politics. You always want to track Trump. That's fine. That's your point of view. I understand that. What about all the stuff Hillary has done? I don't hear that. Another question I have, when we keep talking the $15 minimum wage, sure, that feels great, but these jobs that are minimum wage are not meant to be a lifestyle. Go to college or get a trade, better yourself. What I don't hear
the Democrats explain is if you make $15 an hour minimum wage and I make $20 an hour, you were at 7 or 8 or whatever it is, you brought up the lower class to the middle class, but essentially what you've done is also the middle class is not going to get that increase. They are, their employers are going to say, hey, minimum wage went up $7 an hour, I'll give you that. They're not going to. So what you've essentially done is brought the middle class down because all the wages have gone up, all their costs, everything of living has gone up, but their personal wages have not gone up. I don't believe.
All right, let's get a response. Ruth.
Well, the $15 an hour minimum wage, if you work 40 hours a week, is $600. So, you know, the fact is we have a lot of service sector workers who are supporting their families, and it's not high living. So, you know, the reason that you see 70 to 80% support for hiking the minimum wage in this country is that people know how hard it is to get by. They, you know, learning a trade and making a solid middle class income is a great idea, and it is becoming increasingly hard. We hear a lot about how people should get trained for jobs. We don't see a lot of those jobs, though. We've been outsourcing manufacturing in this country for decades now. So people are struggling if they are, falling into that minimum wage sector of the economy, and they are mostly adults. They are mostly women with children. So it's important to figure out how people are supposed to get by. And the thing I think that really drives home the injustice of the very low minimum wage is the degree to which corporate profits have increased at the same time that wages have flatlined in this country. So, you know, the Walton family, six members of the Walton family who have more money than the bottom 150 million Americans, you can afford to pay a little more to the people who are, you know, checking you out at Walmart. And it's the difference between having a decent life and being on food stamps at the same time that you're working full time.
Thanks, Kyle, for the call. Mary in Middleton, hi. Mary, turn the radio down, please. Mary, I'll get back to you. You've got to turn the radio down or nobody can understand anybody. Claire in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm such a fan of you and Ruth, too.
Thanks, Claire.
Thank you.
I get my Progressive every 2 months, Ruth.
Excellent.
Two things I'd love to get your comments on, Ruth. As an insider, one, I'm so concerned about all these stories we've been hearing with the primaries around the country. I'm not talking about the voter ID law now. I'm talking about problems with people discovering that their registrations were wiped out in the computer system and they no longer even exist in the voter rolls. Machines broken, lines for 6 hours. All that stuff, is that going to be, Ruth, is that stuff going to be fixed, do you think, by November? Or are we going to have a disastrous November election? That's one thing. And number two, it seems to me the Democratic Party, and for that matter the Republican Party, the party machines, if they were smart, they have all these people that are kind of dangling. If they were smart, they would want to draw these independents in to vote for their Democratic or Republican candidates. They would want these people to vote for their people and increase the size of their parties. And I don't understand this exclusionary attitude they have towards independence.
Well, those are two really good questions that come out of this election. I mean, there was a big scandal in New Mexico about the long lines, about people prevented from voting who, in fact, were eligible to vote. And I think that's an ongoing scandal in the United States of America, which should be able to run elections where it's easy to vote, and there's no question about it. You know, of course, we're moving in the opposite direction now. We have 33 states or more who have enacted various kinds of barriers to voting, restricting hours, requiring ID, including here in Wisconsin. So in our election, in our primary, we saw students who had proof of residency and they had out-of-state driver's licenses and they could not vote because they had to get a special UWID that was not their normal UWID to allow them to vote. I mean, that is just straight up vote prevention. It is a strategy to prevent people from voting and to sow confusion with all of these new rules that make it hard to vote. And it, you know, that those laws are being enacted to combat a non-existent problem of in-person voter fraud, of which there has been basically none in the country, no cases here in Wisconsin. So, you know, that's an outrage to our democracy, and it's a huge fight. It's a huge civil rights fight. You know, and were you going to say something, Kathleen?
No, I mean, I was, but you go ahead.
The other issue is independence voting. So, I mean, we've seen this in the Democratic primary. In states mm-hmm. where you can vote in either primary, you can vote as a Republican or a Democrat the same day in your primary election. Bernie Sanders did very, very well. And those are that's what the general election is like, right? You can vote for whoever you want to in a general election. In states where there's a closed primary, as in New York, where you had to register as a Democrat in October before you could vote in the very recent New York primary, you exclude a lot of people from participating in the primary. A lot of people didn't think back in October that they wanted to vote in the Democratic primary, but they, you know, many of them, young people, were really galvanized by Bernie Sanders, and they were not allowed to cast a vote for him. And, you know, that has a certain effect, and it's an effect that for an institutional party that wants to retain control is maybe, you know, siphoning things in the direction of their chosen nominee. But it is not fundamentally very democratic.
Thanks, Claire, for your call. Jeff in Washburn. Hi.
Hi. To both of you, I'm a fan of both of you as well. My question I wanted Ruth to comment on was the Bernie or bust mentality that is, I see, prevalent on social media and in organizing. I'm a longtime Bernie supporter, but not to the extent that I would help a Trump presidency succeed or get elected. And there seems to be a progressive intelligentsia that is coming up with a purity test and throwing people like Feingold under the bus because they may support Hillary or our progressive Senator Buley, if she may support Hillary, and demonizing them along with Hillary as members of the oligarch and everything like that. And I don't have my blinders on about Hillary. I think Bill and Hillary have been Republican light from the very start and have made no bones about it. They're not the most progressive, and yet they're not Trump. And I see Trump as Hitler in the early 30s, just getting steam. He scares me. What's your comments, Ruth?
Well, I go back to a conversation I had with Howard Zinn when he was alive about this very issue, and it was whether it was respectable for progressive activists, people who are really on the left and very unhappy with the corporate Democratic Party, to vote for the least worst option in a general election. And Howard Zinn, who is really an icon of grassroots progressive activists, said, of course you vote for the least worst option. It's just not the most important thing that you do. So I do think that it is possible both to have progressive politics that are well to the left of Hillary Clinton and to choose to vote for a candidate who is, you know, the best you're going to do in any given election year. I mean, those are not diametrically opposed things to do, to try to build a progressive movement that will ultimately produce better candidates, and also to go ahead and vote in elections when, you know, your options aren't great, but there's a clear difference.
Thank you so much for the call. I do want to play, because I thought this was pretty striking, Paul Ryan's comments on not being able to support Donald Trump, at least now. There's a meeting on Thursday, but I thought this was really interesting for him to say this, and I want you to respond to it, Ruth, but first let's hear it. Here's Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House.
Donald Trump, will you support him?
Well, to be perfectly candid with you, Jake, I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now, and I hope to, though, and I want to, but I think what is required is that we unify this party.
And then we had, hold on one second, what Donald Trump had to say about all of that.
Well, I've brought in millions of people into the party. We set a record, an all-time record, for votes gotten by somebody running. And as you know, we're up 70%, more than 70%, from 4 years ago in terms of voting. And there's a certain reason for that. I hate to say that it's me, but let's assume it's me. And I was really surprised by it, and it's fine. He can do whatever he wants to do. It's fine. But I was surprised.
And so they're meeting on Thursday. What was Ryan doing there?
Well, I think, Ryan gave that interesting speech where he refused to say much about Trump when he was asked by an audience member. And he talked about looking at the horizon and the long view. I mean, I think he's telegraphing very clearly that he does not support Donald Trump, that he wants to be the leader of a Republican Party that is not represented by Donald Trump, that I think Trump is right. He has his eyes on 2020 to run for president himself. And he's flexing his muscles a little bit. You know, he's trying to establish a counter power to Trump in the Republican Party. And they are in the midst of that battle. It's moved even further since they made those comments, because now they're talking about whether or not Ryan's running the convention, whether he's coming to the convention.
Right.
So it's going to be an interesting meeting on Thursday.
Oh, Ruth, it sure is. It sure is. Let's go to, we have time for a couple more phone calls you can get through. We've been darn busy, but lines are open now. 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political. Ruth Conniff is our guest, editor-in-chief of The Progressive, and we go to Annie in Watertown. Hi, Annie.
Hi. It's so aggravating. I don't know if it's brainwashing or lack of critical thinking, but the comments the caller made against the minimum wage. What if you have gone to college? What if you have gone to tech school, or you're trained, you had a career, and you're out of work because of the economy, and you can't make a living on $7.25, and that's where jobs start. So many jobs start.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a majority opinion now. I mean, I think people really are seeing that. And as Jim Hightower, our columnist in The Progressive, put it, a lot of people see a hairnet in their future. You know, it's people do not feel secure that they are protected, that they are a different class, that they have come out of that working minimum wage economy and they never have to go back. People don't feel that secure. And so at a time when people feel that kind of economic insecurity, it makes sense that there's broad public support for bringing up the floor so you don't fall that far when you fall.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing to me, Ruth, that the people in Washington just, how can you be so out of touch that you had a sense of what's going on with people? We have a sense, talking to people for years on this show, that people are just having a really hard time economically, that the recession isn't over for a lot of people, that there is a huge wealth gap in this country, and somehow Washington is oblivious to this. How can you be so out of touch?
I mean, people do live in a bubble, and they talk to other people like them. And I think, you know, when you have politicians who are really friendly with Wall Street bankers and their kids go to school together and they socialize together,
right.
And the same is true of the Washington Press Corps, you know, you get out of touch with the way the rest of the world is living. And there's been a rude awakening, I think, this year because that gap has gotten too big.
Yeah. Let's go to Maddie in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hi, I'm hoping that Hillary will surprise everyone and myself included, and not do what her husband did, because he put people from Monsanto in charge of key making decisions, and it caused farmers in Indiana and Iowa to lose their freedom of speech and to lose their freedom to do business, and I'm hoping that. I'm a Bernie supporter, and I'm hoping that if she is the one, that she will surprise us all and not do that.
Mm-hmm. Are you about 45 seconds, Ruth?
Yeah, I mean, I think like trade, agriculture is a progressive populist issue, and the overtaking of production by big corporate farms and the policies that help support that have really hurt people in the Midwest, and that's an area where Bernie Sanders really spoke to people.
Hmm. Well, Ruth, I hope we speak to you before then, but I hope you have a really good time at the convention.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's going to be something. Oh, I'll be looking forward to reading what you write. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
It's always great to be with you.
Ruth Conniff, our guest this hour for All Things Political. She is the editor-in-chief of The Progressive and has been for quite some time. She's a Madison native and very well-spoken, good thinker, perfect guest. all things political is something that we have done for years now, and we're in the thick of the presidential election, so this extends, of course, our political conversations to other days of the week. But you can count on Mondays at 1 with discussions from people of all kinds of political persuasions on what's going on in this year's phenomenal presidential race. So thanks to Ruth. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and to KP Whaley for producing this program. And thanks to you for all of your input. We took a ton of phone calls and messages. If you didn't get on the air, go to our Facebook page. We really want to read what you're thinking these days. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. If you like us, then we'll give you information about upcoming shows. Janine Geske will be joining us. Stay with us, doing some very interesting work. First the news, though, coming up soon.